today is Dr. Richard Brunswick, a retired primary care physician with a master's degree in public health and health policy and management. He's a graduate of SUNY at Buffalo School of Medicine, did his residency in family medicine at Duke University. He has a longstanding interest in tobacco addiction and in counseling smokers about quitting. His book is Can't Quit, B-U-L-L-S-H-T. You Can Stop Smoking. It's published by Amblyope Press and is available at richardbrunswick.com as a paperback or EPUB with links to the usual major booksellers. Welcome, Dr. Brunswick.
Nice to meet you, Alan.
Well, pronounce the name of that publisher again.
Amblyope.
Amblyope. I have a lot of friends who are smokers.
Mm-hmm.
And in anticipation of this interview and of giving us this time, I said to them, why don't you quit? You know, in one case, you have diabetes. In another case, your father died early. In another case, we know the stats on this. You have a lot of children or you have some children. Why didn't you? He says, I don't want to. Now, how typical is that?
It's fairly typical. People say they don't want to, often either because they've tried to quit and have not been successful, or they feel beaten up and defiant about their smoking.
Is there a difference between intellectually understanding the whole thing and, just emotionally, quote, I don't want to?
Well, there is a difference, but for many smokers, they don't really have a choice. Smoking's a powerful addiction, and it's not a willpower deficit. People don't not quit, to use a double negative.
Sure.
People don't not quit because they don't want to. They've tried and have learned they can't, because nicotine changes the brain and makes quitting extraordinarily difficult.
How does it change the brain?
Well, the brain has receptors. It has actually nicotine receptors. It has serotonin receptors. It has even receptors we find for cannabinoids, the active ingredient in marijuana. And the brain, as we now understand it, really comes to crave nicotine. So when a young person starts smoking, they don't intend to be a pack-a-day smoker 10 or 20 years later, but that's what happens. I can say more about that if you'd like.
Say as much as you like, because I'm fascinated. I have a lot of follow-up questions just from the paragraph you just gave us. I'm very interested, for example, in things like serotonin. How does that figure in? But why don't you, as a separate receptor?
Sure. Well, for a young person, you take your typical high school or middle schooler who starts smoking. Even the smoker who smokes one cigarette a day or less, 85% of them say they'll be done with cigarettes in a few years, and yet 40% of them go on to smoke for the long term, become regular smokers. 2 out of 3 high school kids say they never would have started smoking if they knew how hard it would be to stop.
So it's like heroin. In other words, you take the first hit and then you're done.
Well, it's a little more than one, but that's correct. It's more addictive than cocaine, more addictive than heroin, and it's not a willpower
deficit.
How
can it really be more addictive than heroin or cocaine?
The withdrawal is extraordinarily hard, and the worst of withdrawal from cigarettes is over in 4 days, but the cravings and mood effects last months. And that's very similar to the street drugs you hear about all the time. The symptoms of withdrawal are not as intense as from heroin, but it's also extraordinarily difficult.
But in the end, it is the fact that somebody has to want to quit.
It is. They have to commit to quit. They can't go through the motions. They can't say, oh, I really ought to quit. I'm going to quit. They need a plan to quit. And actually, in my book, I give a 10-point plan.
You do. And we'll get to that in just one moment. But it extends to virtually everything. I mean, we see young women in high school and college, and they're concerned about weight.
Very commonly. Young women and increasingly young men in the society we live in are using cigarettes as a tool to help control weight.
Does it?
Well, it does, in the sense that nicotine both decreases appetite a little bit and it actually changes how we handle the calories we take in, so that a smoker tends to weigh a little less. And when one quits, commonly there's a weight gain of 6 to 8 pounds, in some people more. I talk about strategies to prevent that weight gain. The interesting thing is that studies show that you'd have to gain over 60, 70 pounds to do as much harm to yourself as you do by continued smoking.
That extends then, we know about appetite. What about sex? Is smoking sexy to these folks who do it? Does it either increase or lower your sexual libido or appetite?
Well, for men in particular, ultimately it lowers sexual performance. You see all the TV ads for erectile dysfunction.
Yes, indeed.
Smoking is a major cause of erectile dysfunction.
Is it?
It really is.
How do we know that?
Generalized atherosclerosis, the same condition that causes heart attacks and strokes, commonly smoking is a major contributor, also causes the same blood vessel damage to the vessels that supply the penis.
Okay, so atherosclerosis. So how does smoking, from a scientific perspective, change the way in which the blood circulation occurs?
Basically, fatty deposits occur in the lining of blood vessels, and smoking, the toxins in cigarette smoke, and it's not nicotine, it's the over 4,000 chemicals in cigarette smoke that do all the damage to the linings of the blood vessel, to causing cancer and other diseases.
And we can tell from a research point of view that people who smoke suffer more in that way. You mentioned sexual dysfunction. You mentioned now deposits in the arteries. So it's undeniable, right? I mean, there are smokers who tell me it's all a word you use in the front of your title, BS, that it's not true. But it is true, isn't it?
It is true. It's very much true. The average pack-a-day smoker shortens his or her life by about 10 years. And if a smoker stops, and the sooner he or she stops, there is a benefit. In fact, the risk of a heart attack drops precipitously in a matter of hours to days if one stops smoking.
So this business of, oh, well, I didn't stop in time, it's too late, I may as well continue, is a myth.
It's a myth. It's a myth.
So if you're 65 years old and you've been smoking all your life and your wife has been keeping up with you smoking all of her life too, and then you look at each other and say, this is crazy, we love our grandchildren, we want to see our great-grandchildren, and they stop, they are helping themselves how?
They are cutting their risks of a heart attack or a stroke. They may not gain that many years of those 10 or even 20 years back, but the quality of their life for their remaining time will be far better than if they continued to smoke.
Amazing. Okay, now let's get to the book, which is Can't Quit, BS, is what I'm going to say, because there's certain words, get your license taken away on the air. You can stop smoking. Mm-hmm. Now, if you look at this title, Can't Quit, BS, You Can Stop Smoking, referenced by no less than Jane Brody in the New York Times, I will tell you. Let's assume that when you read that, you're being very sympathetic to potential quitters. But when you read the book, you get the idea of just how hard it might be.
The book is actually very sympathetic. The BS word is to confront the smoker and say, actually, you can do this. You think you can't, but you can. And smokers in society today have been beaten up quite a bit. The one thing I don't do is beat up on smokers for their habit. It's why I made the point that it's not a willpower deficit. It's not because they're foolish. It's not because they're not smart. There are compelling reasons in relation to the addiction. Nicotine gives a person a little bit of a stimulus. It gives some relief of anxiety. Smoking, nicotine reaches the brain really quickly, so there's a real buzz. And smoking relieves withdrawal that begins a couple of hours after a last cigarette. So I'm very pro-smoker. I'm very anti the big tobacco companies, however. The high school kid I mentioned earlier doesn't know the trouble he or she is getting into, but big tobacco companies certainly did and does.
So let's go into the book for a moment. The first chapter you have is Before You Quit. Explain that.
That chapter really is about a mindset. It's about understanding your addiction. It's about understanding what withdrawal is all about. And it's getting into the frame of mind and changing one's thinking about smoking. A lot of smokers, for example, say, I can't quit smoking. It's like giving up my best friend. Well, I don't know about you, but my best friends don't poison me. They don't take 10 years away from my life. So it's really about the mindset.
So the chapter is necessary because before you embark, you have to have some sense of what you're going to be facing.
That's correct.
Now, I had a friend, a professor, when I was teaching at New Paltz, and I'd show up at 6 o'clock in the morning. He'd be in there, and he'd be smoking.
Mm-hmm.
And he's dead, and he smoked a lot. Mm-hmm. But he was insulted when I wouldn't smoke with him. I mean, I wouldn't take his cigarette, but he happened to be from another country. I think there was some cultural issue here. But he was angry, really angry. What's that about?
You know, it's an interesting question. It comes up repeatedly when a person quits and friends and family offer cigarettes. And I can't explain it, but I will say that if a person wants to quit, they need to look at that and speak to friends and family and say, hey, do me a favor. I'm trying to quit. It's not easy.
Don't give me a drink.
Don't offer me a cigarette. In fact, let's socialize in places that don't allow smoking. Let's be outdoors. Let's go to the movies. Let's not drink and go to a bar and smoke all night.
The critics that I know of smokers have often been reformed smokers. The toughest people. Let the radio audience know that you're nodding your head and agreeing with that. So you have to intellectually know what you're going to do before you quit, and you have to know that what you're experiencing. Look, you're a doctor. You don't need 10,000 people calling you up and saying, oh my God, I hurt. You're telling them before they quit that they're going to hurt, so
yeah,
they know that.
I'm also helping them understand triggers, routines, and rewards.
Let's talk about all of them.
Paul Duhigg, I think it's Paul, New York Times reporter, wrote a book that's been on the bestseller list called The Power of Habit. It's on the bestseller list now. It's about changing habits. Mm-hmm. And he's the one who's popularized this. Researchers studied it. Smokers get triggers for lighting up. They smell cigarette smoke. They've paired smoking to having a cup of coffee or a beer. They see someone else smoking. It's an immediate automatic trigger to light up. So I give background so that smokers can identify their own triggers and get that off of autopilot.
So the trigger is?
The trigger is a stimulus, a place, a sensation, such as a smell or something they see. It's a mood. Some smokers light up whenever they're stressed out. A trigger is a stimulus to lighting up.
I have a trigger. Let's see if it's the same thing. I get up at 3:30 in the morning. I got to work. Usually, I leave work about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I get in the car, and I will give my life for a Diet Pepsi.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know Diet Pepsi is not good for me, but it is something I've tried to get off and have succeeded, a point you make quite well in your book, which is sometimes you have to try a couple of times. But what about substitutions? I worked for a congressman once whose psychiatrist told him that he should have one of those things that you give to little babies in his mouth to take away the sense of smoking, because he always smoked. He smoked a pipe. It was bad for him. So are there substitutes you can use for smoking?
You know, people, when they want to quit, carrying a water bottle, sipping frequently, gratifying the oral sensation, the feel. Cigarettes have a mouth feel that tobacco companies actually manipulate to keep people hooked.
Tell us more about that.
Well, they give cigarette smoke a flavor and a body. You know, people talk about the body of a beer. Cigarettes have flavor and a mouthfeel that is manipulated by additives by the cigarette company.
Is there any association between memories of the breast, because you would talk about oral, quite Freudian, and those people who smoke?
I don't think we need to go there. I think it's as satisfying as eating and drinking, something we all do every day. But I suppose the Freudians might have an opinion, but they have fallen out of favor in our times these days.
Doesn't mean they're not right.
No, it doesn't mean they're not right. There's clearly an oral gratification. The use of the mouth, the hands, and the nicotine addiction all go together.
And you claim, and it sounds right to me, that the cigarette companies are doing scientific research in which they can manipulate those triggers to make you want more.
They do. Not so much the hands, but the mouth and the flavor and the feel. And they manipulate triggers as well. Their product placement in movies is really all about, still all about selling cigarettes. You asked about, is there something intrinsically sexy about smoking? Mm. No, there isn't. But images in film have paired post-sex smoke or the curling rise of cigarette smoke in a sexy scene or the way someone holds their cigarette. This is all paired now and serves as a trigger.
Do cigarettes ever act as a substitute for sex? I'll give you a story, which I probably shouldn't. I once had a sort of semi-girlfriend early in life, very early in life, who would, every time I would sort of make the move, she would light up a cigarette. And I've always wondered whether or not that was an intrinsically defensive move, using the cigarette to ward off sexual impulse or even predators.
Sounds like it might have been for her, but, you know, it reminds me of the old joke, do you smoke after sex? And the answer is, I don't know, I never looked.
Yuck. Okay, let's talk a little bit more about triggers. Are there, when you do your research or when research has been done, are there common triggers that smokers have that you could name?
Smelling cigarette smoke, seeing cigarette smoke, the flavor and taste of coffee.
Coffee is a trigger?
Coffee's often paired with smokers.
Do you know why?
I do not know why. I don't think it's known, but it is commonly described. Uh-huh. So a smoker will have their morning or after dinner cup of coffee with a smoke. And the smell of brewing coffee serves as a trigger for many smokers. Obviously not all, but many.
Not to carry on this sexual stuff too much, but you do reference it in your book that there are some people who have sex and they got to have a cigarette. What's mm-hmm. that about?
Further relaxation, I suspect. I don't know. The nicotine fix is relaxing. It's a stress reducer. It's a timeout and a break. It's paired with taking a break. But I don't know.
What should employers do? I'm an employer here at the radio station, in order to help their employees quit. Now, I've talked to several of them, and, you know, they look at me as if I'm from outer space. What do you do?
If you're involved with human resources and benefits, you make sure that health insurances cover smoking cessation programs. You may give a monetary reward to people who quit.
That's an interesting idea.
Yeah. You may bring in smoking cessation workshop from groups like the American Lung Association or help your employees access them. What you don't do, which has been happening now, is create a no hiring policy for smokers. Mm-hmm. The New England Journal of Medicine has two articles on the ethics of that, one by Rahm Emanuel's brother Ezekiel. And he talks about the ethical problems with not hiring smokers.
What are they?
Well, you're basically
smoking. You know it's going to cost your health insurance more. I agree with you, by the way. I mean, it's ridiculous. Right. But I don't see what he's talking about. The fact of the matter is, you know, health insurance is going to be affected, your rating, by hiring people who are going to kill themselves.
The issue for smoking, first of all, smoking tends to be something that lower income folks do more than upper income folks. So you're taking away employment opportunities from people who need employment possibly more than others in these times. Basically, insurance itself is a way of pooling risk. We're paying for health care for people who drive at excessive speeds.
Right.
It's a shared risk item, and smoking is part of sharing the risk in the society. It's basically penalizing the victims of big tobacco companies, and I don't think that's fair.
Two of the smartest people I know, and I'm old now, but two of the smartest people I know are smokers.
Mm-hmm.
Explain that to me.
It's a statement of how someone likely began at an early age and how mm-hmm. powerful the addiction is, and that smoking addiction is not a failure of willpower and not a sign of stupidity. These are smart people, and yet they have found themselves powerless to cope with and deal with their addiction. They're victims.
Chapter 2 is 10 Steps to Quitting. And I guess everybody who's listening to this, who's a smoker or who knows a smoker or who wants to help somebody else, wants to know what those 10 steps are.
Sure. I'm going to not take them in order, but talk about them in order of importance. I think committing to quit is, which I've mentioned, is probably the most important. The taking the decision to quit and meaning it, letting your friends know, family know that you're going to quit, and also not beating yourself up if you've tried to quit before and have stayed with smoking, because most smokers who do quit have tried multiple times, and it's a sign of a higher success rate to have tried previously. A second step is to use supports. If you do it on your own, your quit rate probably ranges from between 5% to 12%. If you do it with a smoking quit line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW, or a website, www.smokefree.gov, your quit rates really increase. So I talk about getting support.
Well, explain those two places to me that you're going to. How will they help you?
Well, these provide people. So the quit line gives you a person who's a trained tobacco cessation counselor, who knows the ropes and the pitfalls, why people slip up and have a cigarette, why they return to smoking. So when a smoker has a craving, for example, and the urges to light up are powerful, when a smoker has a craving and calls 1-800-QUIT-NOW, 24 hours a day, they can speak with someone who can talk them through that and help them with coping strategies to resist the cigarette.
So give us an idea about what that conversation might sound like.
The conversation might be to let the person know that most urges to smoke pass in a matter of minutes.
Interesting.
That if they distract themselves by going for a 5-minute, 10-minute walk, or if they delay, distract, drink, and take deep breaths, they're more likely to be able to resist smoking. So taking slow, deep breaths, calming deep breaths, and doing that for about as long as you would typically smoke a cigarette can really help you resist an urge to smoke.
What else?
Snacking, that oral gratification, snacking on vegetable sticks, unbuttered popcorn, sucking candies, sugar-free sucking candies, sipping water, that will help. Holding something in your hand, playing video games, playing computer games on a cell phone, doing craft or hobby, knitting, these are all ways to resist because you're using your hands, you're using your mouth, and you're not smoking.
So when your patients come to you, who you've worked with, they lay these things on you? They say, Doc, I tried, but I can't do it?
Very regularly. And, you know, I've mentioned Quitline and smokefree.gov, but there are the standard medications people use.
What are those?
Those are nicotine replacement products like the gum and patch, a drug called Zyban, also known by the names Wellbutrin or Bupropion, and the one advertised on TV a lot lately, Chantix or Varenicline. They double quit rates.
What do they do? What's the chemistry?
They either decrease the urge or craving to smoke, or they decrease the withdrawal symptoms that come from not smoking.
Do we think that there are character categories, people with some categories, you know, we've always heard about type A, for example, who are more likely to smoke than others? In other words, once we get their profile.
No, but there are different types of smokers. So that, for example, President Obama I don't know if he's still smoking. It's like FDR's polio. You didn't see him in a wheelchair. It's hard to know about President Obama's current smoking status. But there are occasional smokers who smoke once a week at a poker game and never take up the habit and are able to do that for many years. Roughly 1 in 10 smokers smokes in that fashion. And then there's
what we call a social smoker.
A social smoker. I wouldn't suggest taking up smoking thinking you'll be one, though.
Yeah, because, you know, it's the
risks
road,
are
it's
too
the road
great.
To hell.
Right.
Yeah. So you, as a physician, as an MD, are allowed to prescribe. Do you find yourself prescribing a lot when people come in your practice and complain that they haven't been able to do it?
I did, but there's a trap for physicians. And the trap for physicians who are under the gun and pressed to see people with increasingly less time to do it is to just say, oh, you want to quit? Pick a quit date. Here's a prescription. And that doesn't suffice. It helps, but it doesn't suffice. Medicare and health insurers have just started to pay for cessation, smoking advice sessions. And having office staff trained to do that is part of this. If a person has a quit date and receives a call from their clinician, and it could be a nurse or a nurse practitioner, quit rates are much better.
I want to talk to you a little bit about who to go see. Obviously, if you're an MD in this country, you're allowed to prescribe in a way that social workers, psychologists are not, because they don't have that degree. But you can't see everybody, and physicians have limited time and resources. Who would you recommend people go to see?
Tobacco cessation counselors will increasingly exist in large medical practices, and people will go and see those folks instead for maybe 4 or 5 visits, 20, 30 minutes long.
So if they want you to have a prescription and they're in a medical practice, even though they don't have a medical degree, they can get one for you from somebody that they're working, an MD that's working with you. Is that your
correct
point? Yeah.
That's correct.
Well, but then what about the single practitioners, you know, who are social worker with a shingle out there? Sometimes they have relationships with docs who can do this
right.
kind of thing.
Right. Many have relationships. Many physician offices have staff trained to do this work and then can access the prescribers to get the prescription called into a pharmacy.
We are talking to Richard Brunswick, Dr. Richard Brunswick, MD. The name of the book is Can't Quit, Bulge, You Can Stop Smoking. Doc, let me ask you about the quitting. We've taken on some ways to quit. Give us some more.
Well, I think it's important to have a plan for slipping up. You know, a smoker will often go two weeks without a cigarette, have one evening, and then throw away the 2 weeks.
In other words, okay, I'm done.
I blew it. Yeah, it's over. I'm done. And I give smokers a way to think about that, to challenge their thinking and say, gee, I blew it, but I'm sticking with this.
And what way do you give them to do that?
I have them actually think about how they've managed to resist a smoke in the past in prior attempts. I have them strategize. Say it's a married couple, and they typically go out to dinner with friends or to a bar, and they have a drink with dinner and then light up afterwards as they're walking to their car. I have them strategize that and plan in advance of going out how they won't do that this time.
Let me talk to you about psychology. Mm-hmm. There is, of course, a very famous doc who thinks that the back is the great repository of angst, and says, you know, I interviewed him for an hour, and the question is, you know, what do you do? And he says, well, you have to find out what the problem is, and then you get rid of the problem, and then you don't have back pain anymore. Mm-hmm. Basically, that's the theory. So now I'm asking you whether the same way of thinking can't be applied to smoking. Guy's in a bad relationship with a wife with a husband, and when it gets bad enough, smokes. Would getting rid of the wife or the husband, I find that sort of outrageous, but he swears it works, wouldn't that be a part of a smoking cessation program?
I think you're making me laugh, Alan. stress reduction would be part of a smoking cessation program.
So if you get to the root of the stress.
Yeah, that would be a small piece. But, you know, we're talking about quitting, and I want to say that one thing I've thought a lot about and write about is that there are two ways to quit. One is to quit, as we've been discussing, and the other is to quit smoking, but to continue using nicotine that you obtain by routes other than smoking. And that's a key part of quitting that's not commonly discussed.
Well, why don't you discuss it a little? And okay. What are those products?
Sure. There's good evidence that for an individual smoker who ingests nicotine by routes other than cigarette smoke, because as we've talked about, it's the smoke that carries the toxins, that they can reduce their health risks of smoking, of all those diseases, by between 90 and 98%. And increasingly, there are products to do that, which you just asked me about. I stopped on the way here on the Mass Pike at one of the stops, and noticed that at the Cumberland Farms, they were selling cigarettes, electronic cigarettes, and little tins, metal tins, of a form of tobacco called snus or snus, S-N-U-S. These methods, electronic cigarettes, or even the FDA's announcement last week that people can stay on the patch or gum longer than 3 months, are all far safer.
Now, the patch and the gum, just to be clear on this, deliver nicotine into your system. Is that
they
right?
They do. The patch releases...
But isn't nicotine... Didn't you tell us nicotine is poisonous in itself?
No, nicotine, except ingested in very high doses, is an extremely safe drug. Yes, extremely safe drug. I know that's surprising. The dangers of cigarettes come from the over 4,000 chemicals in the smoke other than nicotine. Now, nicotine ingested in large quantities, especially by a child, is toxic. But usually there are symptoms like nausea, vomiting, jitteriness that antedate any other more serious symptoms.
So is the nicotine presented in that can that you saw, is that scientifically rarefied? In other words,
yes.
it gets it away from all those other things that,
yes,
that you're talking about.
It does. And this has been shown to be a great way to reduce harm. This is a concept called harm reduction. We use harm reduction when we have use seatbelts in cars, when we have a designated driver if someone's going to be drinking, or when we give methadone to heroin addicts, or we use condoms to prevent sexually transmitted diseases. These are all harm reduction strategies. And in the United States, currently, we're not using harm reduction strategies in the public health venues around smoking. In Sweden, by contrast, they are using harm reduction strategies. And they are...
Like?
Well, they're using... Snus is particularly commonly used
in
Sweden.
Spell that for you.
S-N-U-S.
Okay.
And so most of your listeners are familiar with the baseball player or athlete's chewing tobacco,
yeah,
which requires spitting and causes an increased rate of oral cancers.
Yeah.
These newer forms...
I know this baseball player years ago, a pitcher, who started a company or runs a company which basically encourages young children to get chewing gum in a box that looks like what the major leaguers are chewing on. I've decried this. I think it's a terrible thing because basically it gets the kid into the idea that somehow they may graduate, you know,
right,
from gum to the real thing. I just thought I'd mention that because...
No,
it really
I agree with you.
Off.
It's a terrible thing. But these new forms are like tiny tea bags about the size of a chiclet.
Yeah, yeah.
And they go between the gum and upper lip. They don't cause oral cancer. They vastly cut all the rates of diseases like lung cancer.
And we know this from epidemiological...
We know this epidemiologically,
yeah,
from Sweden. But it's controversial because we know for an individual pack-a-day smoker who switches that their health outcomes will be vastly improved. We don't know at the societal level if this will be bad for society. So that,
for example,
well,
why would it be bad for society?
The concern of some of the major groups like the American Cancer Society here or the American Lung Association is that this will lead to young people graduating up from using other products to smoking, analogous to pot smokers will become heroin addicts, an argument of the 50s and 60s that was not borne out. In Scandinavia, this has not been borne out. It has been shown to divert young people who would otherwise become smokers to staying with these products.
Probably sold by the cigarette companies.
It is. So there are a cast of characters here that are ones that I don't trust. We have big tobacco. We have big pharma. We have big tobacco. Big tobacco is moving into electronic cigarettes. We have electronic cigarette users and their manufacturers.
Okay, stop right there. I want to talk to you about electronic cigarettes.
Okay.
What are they?
Electronic cigarettes are a device that has a battery or power source that has a form of liquid nicotine and that, in essence, releases nicotine as a vapor. And over 3 million Americans are using these. Every convenience store is selling these.
Are they expensive?
It depends on the state you live in comparison. So you might buy one for $10 or $11. That's equivalent to two packs. If you live in a low-cost tobacco state, you would not save money. If you live in New England, you would definitely save
money.
How
long will one electronic cigarette last?
It depends on how the user uses them. So it's a different way of smoking. But these are not regulated and not well studied yet.
Okay, but I need you to stop for a minute because I'm fascinated by this electronic thing. I know one of my smoking people here has tried it. I'm just interested in how they work. Are they as satisfying? Are they as socially acceptable? When somebody's out there with an electronic cigarette as opposed to, they look like regular cigarettes? I mean,
they may have a light source at the end that's like a light. It's not lit. It's not something that's burning.
It's like the old candy cigarettes are a little red thing.
Right. These are not regulated. They're not well studied, but many people have used them already to quit. And they've been banned in the European Union, or they're in process of being banned in many countries. Because the concern is, again, either a gateway effect or dual use or weakening of anti-smoking regulations. And I don't call for all these things as great products societally, but I maintain that for the individual smoker, by any means, stopping smoking, staying on the gum or patch, switching to snus, or using electronic cigarettes would be far better than smoking.
Has anybody given you a hard time on that?
It's interesting. No one yet, but I know that the organizations I mentioned would. I also know that there are other organizations that agree with me, like the American Association of Public Health Physicians.
American Cancer Society?
American Cancer Society would disagree with me. American Lung Association would disagree with me.
Why would they disagree with you?
Well, it depends on what you believe. I, by nature, am not conspiratorial. You know, there are those who would say they would disagree with me because they're in bed with the big tobacco and big pharma, et cetera. I don't believe that for a minute. I think they would disagree with me because they're by nature more conservative and say, we don't know in this country the societal and population effects, and we don't want to potentially cause harm. And I make a real distinction in my book. For the individual smoker, it's not in question, and that we need more research dollars going to study this so that we have a better understanding of the population effects. Sweden, we have data for. It's clearly better. A study in the Scandinavian Journal of Public Health in 2009 showed that if the EU used Swedish snus, there would be 54% fewer lung cancer deaths and 250,000 smoking attributable deaths in 1 year.
Why do smokers get lung cancer from a physiological point of view?
The easy answer is because of the toxins in smoke. It's not from the nicotine. Basically, chronic irritation and known carcinogens such as benzene, which is an identified carcinogen in smoke, cigarette smoke, which is a byproduct not of nicotine, but of burning leaf tobacco plus additives.
That makes sense. What else you got in your 10 steps to quitting that we haven't mentioned?
Having a quit buddy, picking a quit date, going cold turkey, and possibly wild turkey.
What's wild turkey?
Wild turkey is an idea I coined. So turkeys live out in the wild. Pairing your smoking to something that's a bit out in the wild also helps a person learn to resist smoking. So if you decide, okay, I'm going to cut my cigarettes down to 5 a day from a pack a day, and I'm going to have all of those outside in the garage or on the patio, but not in the house anymore. Or if I have a smoking break at work, I'm going to have to walk 5 minutes away from the front door before I light up.
Which is probably why most of us say, it's by law. You can't smoke in a place of business anymore.
That's correct. That's by law, though.
And the theory is that...
The theory for that as well is that passive cigarette smoke is harmful to the other non-smokers in the environment.
So if I'm running a business, as I mentioned before, should I try to shame them? Is shame a good thing? I mean, I was thinking about, I tried it once, it didn't work. Instead of letting them congregate around the front, outside on the sidewalk, I went out with a blue piece of chalk, and right next to the gutter, I drew a box and said, you want to smoke? You have to smoke in this blue box. You cannot smoke by the door. And so you get this sort of effect where you have a population of puffers, and more in this country, we regard these people as being, you know, shameful.
I think they're already feeling shame, many, not all.
And can I help them along?
No, I mean, I have a different approach. I don't beat up on them, and I think shaming them is beating up on them.
Okay, so basically you would allow it. Allow them to stand by our front door.
No, I would not allow that. I agree with you completely, but I would not allow it for those who have to enter the front door and breathe cigarette smoke. And even as if you're the boss here, corporate image, so to speak. But in terms of shaming, I don't think shame is really a useful tool.
I buy it. Is there another way to do this? I mean, how about interventions? You know, you read about bringing a whole bunch of people into a room and confronting a guy and saying, you have to stop this. This is antisocial behavior. You know, those kinds of interventions. Does that make any sense?
You know, I think that if an individual smoker's loved ones express their concern and really communicate their concern, look, we're concerned about your health. You're 38. You've been smoking. We love you. We want you to be around. That can be useful. Would you do this for us? The TV-like intervention for the alcoholic drug abuser where you're really in someone's face, I don't feel like that would be particularly useful.
You think you're too nice? You sound like a nice guy. I mean, you know, I'm not so sure I'd be nice in these cases. I mean, you're a doc. What do I know? But that being nice, too nice, is really helpful for an addict.
Maybe I'm too nice.
I once worked very briefly. I was sent out for my PhD program to Daytop Lodge and Village. Mm-hmm. They used to put people in the corner with a dunce cap, you know, on and try to re-educate them as if they were a baby. This is early on. I don't think they do it anymore. Diapers, you know, on them. They were very tough because, you know, addiction is a very difficult thing to get out of. But one of the things I learned was that after somebody got to a particular age, that's when they stopped being a dope addict. In other words, you got to 35 or 40, I don't remember what the age was. You sort of lived through that crisis of heroin and the rest. Is there any such phenomena in smoking?
There is a phenomenon. It's not uncommon for smokers in their 40s to realize that they're not getting quote-unquote pleasure from their cigarettes. They're merely getting relief of withdrawal. They're getting a break, the smoking break. They can take the break without the smoke.
It's very important that we reiterate this. I know we've said it before, but that part of why you take that next cigarette is that you're already in withdrawal from the last cigarette.
Right.
With formal withdrawal.
Right.
And that you have to take the next cigarette to avoid that pain.
That's correct. And that discomfort is significant to a smoker. But the worst of that is over 4 days after stopping. The cravings don't end.
Do they ever end?
They diminish over time. For many, they don't end, but they're more easy to resist.
Okay, so the third chapter is after you quit and the techniques for staying off the weed. And there are a number of them that you have, but the one that I know that is practiced at some of the alcohol cessation things is you have a sponsor. Do you see any need for that here?
Yeah, I think having a quit buddy, especially someone who's quit before, who you trust, who could be your go-to person, can be extremely helpful. Someone you know who's quit, who can give you some advice. Very useful.
But picking the right person, it seems to me, is very important. I mean, you can pick somebody with no tolerance, shut up and stop, or you find somebody who really will spend some time with you, and that becomes very important, that whole thing.
I agree.
Is there a way of doing it? In other words, suppose somebody doesn't have a quit buddy. You have AA, which provides some of that stuff, but is there any such thing in smoking cessation?
There are occasionally groups, and you can identify someone in a quit smoking group, but the closest thing to that in these times is the quit line, because you can call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and speak to someone who will talk you through a craving urge, give you advice about problems if you're having side effects from one of the medications, and can just be a useful resource.
Now, there's been a tremendous amount of money that has been raised by government as a result of all of this. There have been accusations, particularly here in New York, that money from the American Cancer Society others, may not be used for what it was supposed to be used for. Just it's used to generally support government as opposed to helping people quit smoking.
Right. And I don't know enough to comment on that, Alan. I'm sorry. I'm not knowledgeable about that area.
That's fair enough. But do you find enough people having the necessary resources from government that they should have? I mean, the tax is on it. I think it's a buck a cigarette or something now. I don't remember what it was, but it's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money.
And that money was supposed to go to smoking cessation. Without your knowing specifically whether that money is going to smoking cessation, you have patients and had patients. Do they have places that they can call up and get that kind of help?
If they're well insured, they do. If they're not, they don't.
So if you were king, if you were emperor, what would you do?
Well, the FDA took a good step in saying that people could stay on the gum and patch longer than 3 months. That happened a week ago.
Until we find out, by the way, as we do with so many drugs, that there are harmful effects. Right now, the FDA has studied it, but the FDA has studied a lot of things that turn out to be not kosher.
They have, but compared to smoking, I'm not worried about it. Mm-hmm. There's no evidence that
sure. You know,
there are concerns about, say, the drug Chantix, that it increases suicidal ideation, mm-hmm. suicidal thinking, that it might cause an increased rate of heart attacks. There are concerns about that. And you're quite right. We may find down the road that it really is a problem. But for at least the gum and the patch, there's no real evidence of problems with that at this point. Now, there are people who have side effects. You asked me the question about if I were the emperor, I would tax cigarettes more. I don't believe that middle schoolers and high schoolers really understand, and I don't think health curricula are really showing and explaining to young people what their likelihood of being lifelong smokers, that this is a decision. It might be from coming from rebellion. It might be coming from peer group pressure. But I don't think the average middle schooler who lights up has a clue. And I don't think parental figures, other than saying smoking is bad or teachers saying smoking is bad, I don't think people are really communicating to young people about.
So how do you make that better?
I think the health curricula in schools, I think groups like Action on Smoking and Health are trying to do that. The tobacco settlement was supposed to be used for that, and you're right. Some of that money has been diverted for general state revenues. But I think we have to spend money on this. And, you know, this is one of these, I don't have the figures, but it's one of these examples of for each dollar spent, we save a significantly greater number of dollars. That's known.
Well, I want to thank Dr. Richard Brunswick, MD. Can quit bull. You can stop smoking. Richard Brunswick, this is very important work, and I think every smoker should have it. Everybody should get one and give one. Again, it's Richard Brunswick, MD, can't quit bull. You can stop smoking. And it's available online as an ebook, but it's also available in bookstores. And you know what? It can't hurt to, if you know a smoker, to get a hold of this in the small book and send it to them, and they can put it in their lavatory reading room and just read a little bit as they go. So thank you for being with us.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks. And I'll just say it isn't in all bookstores, but it is available in paperback at richardbrunswick.com.
Richard, again, thanks so much for spending all this time with us.
Thank you, Alan.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.